Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Daily Objective. And today we're going to be continuing and wrapping up our conversation from last Friday, Conf for Beginners. And as we saw, Conf for Beginners is still like trying to explain rocket science to a toddler. I mean, it's complex and nearly impossible any way you go about it. But that's one of the lessons that I guess we're sort of learning and trying to understand. Who is Kant and what did he say? Today we're going to get to a couple more points that I wanted to bring up. We're going to get to a few of the super chats from last week that were substantive that I never got to read aloud to the resident, not expert, but virtual expert for our purposes. And we're going to get to any super chats you send over today, God willing, knock on wood, whatever you believe, please say a prayer. Because time flies when you're trying to understand Kant. And I can't tell you how happy I am to have Jason Rhines back on the show. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Raka.
So let me start with this. We spoke about the various philosophical approaches in the centuries leading up to Kant. Some of them rationalists, some of them classified as empiricists, and maybe some other kind of groups people can think of them as. But someone like John Locke, who lovers of liberty and lovers of science might see him as like one of the better philosophers, even he would perhaps improperly separate an object from its characteristics. Let's say like he would separate a rose from the color red or something like that. And he would say, okay, the color is just, that's just how it interacts with your eyes, but the... And same with the smell, but let's say something else about the rose is essentially it. And so I wanted to ask you, is it right to say that philosophers like that are improperly conflating metaphysics with epistemology? Because epistemologically, it is correct to separate like the essential characteristics from the non-essential. But metaphysically, these things are all part of the same one object.
So... you can say a lot about problems in some of Locke's views about our knowledge of objects. But I don't think his problem is that he regards, say, essences as metaphysical rather than epistemological. Quite the contrary. Locke is a conceptualist. He thinks that our general ideas, what we would call concepts, are based on abstraction. And that when we abstract, we take a number of things, we compare them, we remove the differences, we retain the agreements between two different complex ideas. So I take away what the differences between you and myself, and I retain, you know, like, you know, formerly Jewish objectivist or whatever, something like that. But when I do that, I kind of make a rule or a name for the general idea, a nominal essence. And these are not metaphysical. These are epistemological. These are our rules for sort of organizing things. Now, that's not quite his view of abstraction isn't the same as, say, Rand's view of abstraction, and his view of nominal essence isn't the same as her view is of definition, but it's not a notion of metaphysical essence. When it comes to metaphysical essence, Locke says, look, as far as we can tell, everything that a thing is and has is essential. Like, if you want to, like, Locke, this is, a lot of people look to Locke for personal identity. And Locke says at one point, like, look, in a sense, like, you change anything, you change the thing, you know, that's the thing. And he thinks now there may be something like real essence. And when he talks about real essence, he means one of two things when he uses the term real essence. Either he means what scholastics meant as a kind of moderate realist Aristotelian thing, like there's manness in man. And that kind of real essence, he says, does not exist. He thinks that is bogus. There's no such thing. Or by real essence, he means like, you know, like the subatomic structure or the atomic structure of things, which in Locke's time, chemists like his friends Hooke and Boyle were looking for, but they hadn't found yet. And Locke thinks there may be something like that. We don't know what it is yet. We may or may not get closer to that as time goes by. And so the real essence in that second sense, he does think is, you know, is there, but we don't know what it is for most things. And he does think there is an epistemological difference between knowing that there sort of is a substance and knowing the kinds of properties or appearances that are caused in us from knowing its real essence in that second chemistry sense. And so he does think that, so yes, he does think that there's a difference between the smell of a flower, which as it appears to us, and the powers that cause it to have that smell for us. But there's a sense in which, you know, we recognize that consciousness has a form as well as an object, and that the form may not be the same for the same object. So I may not see this thing the same way a dog does, but we're both seeing the same thing. So there's something, there's something that's not totally wrong. Basically, the primary secondary quality distinction I'm mentioning, like the smell of the rose versus some property that causes it, basically it's problematic, but there's, it's not totally crazy when you think about the fact that different conscious beings experience the same object and even the same facts about the object in different ways, or could. So, okay, so to sum up, Locke rightly thinks that essences are not metaphysical, they're epistemological. He has the wrong view of the mechanism by which we form them. His view of abstraction doesn't work right. But it's better for trying to find a process in the mind that actually groups things together rather than something in the thing that just holds them together as a group. And he's right to think there's no such thing. The deepest problem for Locke, as well as for so many other philosophers in major metaphysicians and epistemologists in the 17th and 18th century, is this way of ideas, this kind of view that what we directly perceive, so to speak, directly experience, is our own consciousness of things rather than consciousness directly perceiving things.
Right. In objectivist terms, would you say Locke is rejecting intrinsicism but maybe getting a little too close to subjectivism?
Yeah. That's quite, when it comes to how we form concepts, yes. Because you could basically form a nominal essence however you wanted. Now Locke thinks that there are certain practical norms that are sort of guiding us. We don't tend to form these things willy-nilly, but he thinks, and this comes out when he thinks about what he calls mixed modes and things, like you could put these together however you wanted. And yeah.
Wow. You know, anytime I talk to somebody as learned as you, you know, it can be a little frustrating or it can be humbling, I should say. But every once in a while, I just get a yeah, like that just now. And it's all worth it. But so this practice of conflating metaphysics with epistemology, would you say that's more common maybe after Kant with some of the philosophers that came after him? Or
can you say more about what you mean by conflating metaphysics with epistemology? If you mean taking things which are epistemological in nature and treating them as metaphysical, that tends to be the kind of that tends to be what sort of the intrinsicist does. Whereas kind of going the opposite way, taking something metaphysical and treating it as epistemological or social or conventional, because it doesn't always even rise to the level of epistemological if it's not knowledge. But that tends to be more of the route of the subjectivist, put in very simple terms. But maybe you mean something a little bit different. I'm not sure.
I mean, I think I heard that phrase maybe the way that you just described it. So I'm satisfied with your answer just now. I don't need to try and dig deeper to find who's guilty of this crime more than what you just said.
I think on the lectures that I might have done on Kant, you know, 15 years ago, which are, by the way, on the they are on the Ayn Rand University app, I think, now.
And on YouTube now.
Oh, cool. With video?
No, not video, just okay. Audio.
Yeah. So I think I'm at some point I might say something like, particularly in the second or third day of Kant part one on Kant's theoretical philosophy, that Kant takes something sort of metaphysical and makes it, I probably didn't say epistemological, but I might have said psychological or something like that, which is to say that sort of there is a process by which you can take something that is a kind of metaphysical absolute and you can treat it as if it were just a kind of category of the mind. Now, it's not that these things aren't categories of the mind. It's that they're rules of reality sort of first, and therefore properly categories of mind. For example, the laws of logic, right? But as a law of logic, as a kind of rule we apply to ourselves, this is epistemological or mental, if you want to put it that way. But the laws of logic, at least as Aristotle thought of them, and I think as Ayn Rand thought of them, they are metaphysical laws, not in no way unlike physical laws are laws of reality. It's just that though they govern how things work, it's still a possibility for us to have kind of contradictions. And so we have to normatively hold fast to what reality kind of already automatically does for itself.
Yeah, maybe where what I'm thinking of when I talk about the conflation of metaphysics with epistemology is maybe the analytic synthetic dichotomy, the essay by Leonard Peikoff, which is in Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology. Maybe that's kind of where it's most glaring in my reading, because would you say that false dichotomy is an instance of conflating metaphysics with epistemology?
Well, what is the analytic synthetic dichotomy? The analytic synthetic dichotomy is a dichotomy. You claim that there's two different kinds of truths or two different kinds of propositions of knowledge or of judgment. The difference being that one can be resolved, the truth of it can be resolved simply by analyzing the concepts of the subject and predicate, or the concepts it contains, the other, which involves a synthesis of the predicate with the subject in a new way, meaning I'm adding information to what I'm talking about in a way that wasn't all, this is the subject of the sentence or of the judgment or of the proposition, just having that subject, I don't already know X about it. The predicate is X. Now I've added, I synthesized that together. Whereas an analysis is, here's my subject. I say Y. I'm like, oh, Y is already in there. Yes, true, obviously. That is the difference, to the extent that there is a difference, is a mental psychological kind of processing difference. And frankly, in some sense, it's a temporal difference. Like it's, you know, once I synthesize the subject with X, now X is something I know about the subject. So the next time around, Y isn't seeing the subject as X, like, yeah, I already knew that. Why isn't that now analytic? So any kind of metaphysical. So now if you say that there is some metaphysical difference between the synthetic and the analytic, and you say something like analytic propositions are necessary, they're true, the truths that they name are necessary and must be so, or anything I can't imagine otherwise must be so, let's say. Put it instead of analysis and synthesis, put it in the can I imagine it otherwise test or not, which a test that Hume uses a bunch. And here I could imagine it otherwise in this other case, right? Like I could imagine this steel beam floating or I could imagine, you know, a cat speaking English. You know, I could picture it in my head. It'd be funny. So I guess it's possible. That would be a case of taking something that's an epistemological difference and making metaphysical hay from, making metaphysical conclusions out of it, right? That it's possible, that it's necessary, that it's not necessary, or i.e. contingent, all because I know it in some way or don't know it in some way. And that's illicit, right? Like Just because something's imaginable doesn't mean it's possible. Just because something, I couldn't imagine it otherwise, doesn't mean it's necessary rather than contingent. You know, you could imagine, you know, imagine a cultural situation where it's, you know, 200 years ago, where it's unimaginable that the leader of an industrialized nation would be a woman, right? And you're just like, that's inconceivable, right? Doesn't mean it's not possible, right? So yes, that, I mean, that in that sense, it's totally conflating the mental processes. Even if there were principal differences in the mental processes, and I think with synthetic and analytic judgment, that's not even true. At most, it's a question of, do I already know this or do I not know this yet? Not like one is empirical and one is a priori. But even if there were different processes of judging these things, that still wouldn't equate to a difference in the metaphysical status of the facts that they purport to name.
Yeah. Okay. The analytic synthetic dichotomy is about propositions. So I'm not sure if it was appropriate to bring that up.
Or judgments.
I'm not sure if it was appropriate to bring it up about the conflation of metaphysics with epistemology, but nonetheless,
no. That's a good. About,
yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt. That's a good example. At first I was like, is that a case? And it's been a long time since I've read the essay that you named, but as I thought through it, yeah, that's a very good example of conflating the two.
And most importantly, I'll say to the audience, ask yourself, are you doing this? Are you conflating epistemology with metaphysics? You know, that's something that Target should start selling to hang up in your kitchen, right?
You know, I think if you're not a philosopher, putting it at that, even if you are a philosopher, and certainly if you're not a philosopher, putting it at that level, I know you're kind of being humorous, but putting it at that level is a little bit challenging. I think the terms that if your listeners are familiar with these terms from objectivism, the terms that it's a little more actionable to think about is this metaphysical or is it man-made? Or another way to put it is, you know, is this nature? Is this convention? Is the ancient Greek way? So this thing that I think, does it have to be this way? Is this the way, like, just reality and physics and, you know, and works, or could this be different? And if it could be different, is it in my power? Because there are some things that could be different that require, you know, all of society to shift. And maybe you can make a start, but you can't change everything, right? So I think when you ask yourself, is this in my power or not? Could I have changed this or not? That's a way of getting it certain of something that's even more fundamental than what's metaphysical versus epistemological, because all that is epistemological is that which is in our power and volitional, since our faculty of knowing, I mean, perception is not volitional and it automatically knows, but what we do with concepts, what we do with judgments, that all requires us to make choices and direct our mind and so on. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the way you described how intrinsicists and subjectivists have their versions of conflating metaphysics with epistemology, I would say introspectively, if I find myself either you know, treating values as though they're intrinsic and not my own, or if I think that my value judgments supersede or transcend the fact of reality, I'm in a sense engaging in that conflation. But I mean, do you have a comment or should we move on to another item?
No, let's move on.
Okay. So, so jumping over to Kant, he says, stop asking, how do I know these objects in themselves? We can't. Rather than the Copernican revolution is the innate structure, the concepts, which he calls judgments, and the percept sensations, which he calls intuitions, is kind of what you know. And yes,
very, very close. So, so there are in the Critique of Pure Reason, at least there are three basic faculties, cognitive faculties, sensibility, understanding, and reason. There are a priori principles that allow synthetic a priori knowledge in sensibility and the understanding. So the a priori forms or the kind of units given by sensibility are intuitions, and the a priori intuitions that structure experience are space and time. The sort of units of the understanding are concepts, and the a priori concepts are called the categories, and there are 12 of them. Schopenhauer, a major fan of Kant, he thinks of himself as a Kantian, simplifies it to space, time, and causality, and just kind of rolls up all the categories into causality as the most fundamental one. But there are 12. And judgments are, for Kant, judgments, as they were traditionally called in logic, what nowadays logicians deal with as propositions, but used to be called judgments. And but Kant thinks that concepts are always deployed in judgments, and so they're very intimately connected. Anytime we see an object and recognize it under a concept, which Kant thinks we always do, there's a sort of judgment that applies the concept. But and yes, basically that's right.
So it's your inner world that's primary, your consciousness, your innate structures that are primary, and that's all you'll ever really know, because the objects out there are phenomenal, their appearance.
Well, so you have two kinds of experience, as Kant thinks, inner sense and outer sense. Inner sense is dominated by time, and outer sense is dominated by space and time. So both your inner monologue, your inner thoughts, your imagination, that's inner sense, right? And just your sense, your five senses of the world around you. Both of those are phenomenal, meaning they are appearances that are structured by space and time and the categories. And so in that sense, all of that is phenomenal. All of that is already structured by a priori forms of awareness, by a priori intuitions, space and time, and by a priori concepts, the categories. Even yourself, your empirical self, the you know, so for me, Jason, right? That is appearance. That is phenomenal, right? There may be a transcendental self, a transcendental I, which may be where the filters, as it were, or the stamps of the a priori forms reside, so that they apply to whatever, if there's an input, so to speak, what he calls the manifold of receptivity, that may be where that is. But I have no access, I have no more access to the transcendental I than I have to any other noumenal thing, any other thing beyond appearances. Now, that's not 100% true, because when it comes to morality and a sense of our own free will and duty, there Kant kind of helps himself to a little bit of direct access to the transcendental. But in principle, he's not supposed to.
Okay. And the Copernican revolution being, again, just that, like, well, it's not simple at all, but if I could try to simplify it, it's that rather than looking out there and trying to discover what's out there, really, it's in here where the action is, yeah, as far as right, you're concerned.
Even outer sense is in the mind, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Even outer sense, you know, the chair in front of you is phenomenal. It's phenomena, right? It's appearances.
Yeah. Now, the famous or infamous quote, "I found it therefore necessary to deny knowledge in order to make room for faith," you know, roughly translated and paraphrased there. It's the favorite quote for, you know, young objectivists to run around citing and say, see, Kant is an enemy of knowledge. He's an enemy of reason, which is maybe true. But that particular quote is he was denying the false knowledge of the rationalists. So Ayn Rand doesn't like those rationalists either. So this is maybe an opportunity for a lot of students of objectivism to kind of reflect on, are we speaking above our pay grade sometimes? So that quote is Kant was saying, I am disqualifying the way that rationalists try to prove God and prove free will. I am going to leave that up to faith, because we can't know that one way or the other.
I mean, I think it's important. I do think it's important to recognize that the things that Kant says we can't have knowledge of, yeah, these were things that rationalists thought they could prove with these deductive arguments from innate truths, things like the existence of God, the immortality of the soul, freedom of the will. I think it is important to note that Kant was right that these rationalists were building castles in the air. He was wrong to think that these metaphysical questions are not things we can have knowledge of. I think we can have knowledge about whether God exists or not. I think that I know that God does not exist. I think that I know, not that I believe, but I think I know that the will is free. And I think, you know, I know that the soul or consciousness is not immortal, but it does not survive the death of the body. Not just, you know, that as Kant sees it, these are questions where we can neither know that they are true, nor can we know that they are false. Like, we can't know that there's a God. We can't know that there isn't a God. And then if there's some moral reason for believing in God, like it helps us get us through the day or do our duty better, then we have a kind of reason, not an epistemic reason, not an evidentiary reason, but a kind of practical reason to believe it. You know, like it'd be like if your partner tells you something and you're like, I don't know if that's true, but you're like, you know what? Like, I'm just going to believe it just to get along with them. Like, not I'm going to act like I believe it. Like, I'm going to believe it just to get along with them. You're like, that's something sort of illicit. Like, you could find out if it was true or not. And either if they were wrong, convince your partner they're wrong, or keep it to yourself or something. But if you said, I have this incentive to believe this. You know, like, no, you don't have an incentive to believe it. You might have an incentive to act like you believe it. Although any partner that kind of demands that you act like something you don't believe is something you believe is might be problematic.
Yeah.
So that I use that example of that partner just to illustrate the sense of reasons here. Like, the sense of reasons is not evidence. It's some kind of motive. For Kant, it's a most of the time he gives a moral kind of motive. Like, there's this moral reason. So for example, we can't prove if consciousness or the soul, you know, continues to exist after we die or not. That would go beyond experience. But we have this duty to become perfectly virtuous. And it seems like it's impossible in one lifetime. It seems like it would take an infinite amount of time to asymptotically approach. So we have at least some reason to think it should be possible. We have to believe it's possible because morality says we ought to do it. We have to believe it's possible to do it. And no one can prove that it's not the case. You have infinite time to kind of work on this, heaven is just infinite self-improvement or something like that. But there are cases in the Critique of Pure Reason where he gives an epistemic practical rather than moral practical reason. So for example, there's an argument that reason is the systematizing faculty. It's always trying to tie things together. And Kant says, look, for all we know, we live in an impossibly complex universe where, like, you just can't categorize anything, where, like, the laws are impossibly complicated. You can never get them into simple formulas. Like, and the dream of reason would just be defeated. But reason can't, like, the scientist goes to his lab or her lab believing they can find an equation. Like, believing it can be solved. They can't help it. Reason just does that. And now, like, if there were a God, if there were, like, a rational and benevolent author of nature's laws, like, science would be doable. If there isn't, then science could be hopeless, because at the end of the day, it can never be solved. It's too hard. Like, we just live in a universe that can't be cracked, so to speak. And Kant thinks this is a reason, you know, for science. They can't prove one way or the other whether there is or isn't a God, but scientists, you know, insofar or any of us using reason to systematize the world, it's sort of a reason to believe in a sensible author, because we can't help but act like there is one anyway. Like, we can't help but act like there is a solvable solution.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned something towards the end of the episode. Actually, this was actually the very end. I watched back our last conversation at the very end when we were truly out of time. So I couldn't bring this up. But you mentioned how, like, not only do you enjoy reading Kant, but like you find some things about him just very like impressive as a philosopher, or just very clear and consistent in his own way, in his own context. And that actually, ever since I listened and studied your aforementioned lectures on Kant from however many years ago, I always wanted to ask, you know, if I could ask Rand or if Leonard Peikoff was still taking questions. Or I mean, maybe you can answer this. Like, I wonder if Kant influenced Rand in the way that Plato influenced, you know, everyone, in just the way that Kant put certain things. Perhaps his answers maybe helped Ayn Rand see her alternative way of answering the same questions. Or you kind of see
think
what I'm
there's,
saying?
So I think there's two sort of routes here, or two possibilities. Let's take the simpler one first. The simpler one is that as a foil to work against, Kant helped Rand sharpen and refine her own views. I think that's very much true. Others know her exact intellectual history better than I do, but I think she started reading more Kant, talking to Leonard Peikoff when he was still a philosophy student, and then moving beyond that, and then started really kind of reacting strongly. I think that some of her best things, like causality, my favorite things, causality versus duty, you know, just wouldn't be possible without kind of having Kant to react against. And some of her, I think, maybe views in metaphysics and epistemology were sharpened. You know, in the first edition of We the Living, Leo is reading Spinoza and Kant. Because Kant was seen as an individualist philosopher in Soviet Russia, talking an Enlightenment figure. And so she put it like that. She later changed it. I can't remember what she changed it to. But she, you know, but what that shows is she wasn't intimately familiar with Kant's thought early on. So I do think that often reacting against something, and particularly reacting against something so essentialized, a philosopher as essentialized as Kant, which almost no other philosopher is, really helps you kind of say the opposite. So, you know, Kant isn't saying, you know, R, which is a mix of P and a mix of Q and a mix of S. He isn't saying Z, which is a mix of A and a mix of B and a mix of P. He's saying P. Just none of that other crap, like none of the rest of the nonsense. And then you can just say, oh, wow, that's so clear. He's saying it. Well, not P, you know? So I think that probably he did, reading his philosophy and reacting to it and figuring out what was wrong with it, was important. It certainly was very important to her view about the history of philosophy itself and about modern culture and the way that it reflected philosophy and how things had changed. Since he is in some sense a central figure of the last two centuries of philosophy, and since philosophy moves culture, in her view of culture as well. Now, what about the other route? The other route was something that you initially, I think, was initially suggested, which is there in any sense a more kind of positive influence? And what would that mean? Well, it's not a positive influence in the sense that Kant had some good ideas and Rand thinks, oh, that's a good idea. For one thing, I think any idea that a philosopher has, she would want to see in the context of that philosopher's system and would evaluate accordingly. So some people point to Kant's views on rights and say, oh, you know, that's pretty good. And for Rand, like, that's negligible compared to what his ethics and his metaphysics and epistemology, and it's irrelevant because anything that might be good there will be destroyed by the more fundamental things in the rest of his philosophy. But you could say that Kant, you know, in some ways might have clarified certain concepts or certain ideas and sort of put them out there, and then sort of in the general air out there in the ether, they can become a little more detached from his specific philosophical system, and maybe they get reappropriated. I, you know, no concept is jumping out at me as like, oh, you know, like Kant inaugurated using this formulation and cleaned up a century later and then put into Rand's new terms, it became this and she used that. but you can see something, you know, somebody doing something like that. That's not, I don't think that's not inconceivable to me. It's just that nothing leaps out at me as along those lines.
Yeah, I think it was the former route that you described that I was thinking there might be something there. I wish I would have refreshed, looked at my notes before now, but something about his epistemology or like the way he kind of groups things in different ways. But maybe I'm just so unfamiliar with so much of philosophy that Kant saying something strikes me as original when really other philosophers had said something similar.
Well, there's a lot that's very original in Kant, and even if many of the individual parts or pieces he's using are not, he didn't invent. I think the entire orientation of the philosophy and its essentialization, it is pretty original. So I wanted to say something. You know, you mentioned at the beginning that, you know, Kant for beginners, it's a bit like rocket science for toddlers. So look, I won't pretend that Kant is not a difficult read, but I do think that Kant is a readable read. And what I mean there is that there are some philosophers, let's just take one like Heidegger, for example, where I'm not sure that there you can ever get to a point where it makes sense. I'm not completely sure that at any given moment or time, Heidegger exactly knew what he was saying. Some people tell me he did, and some people think he did, and, you know, like, and I tend to think like I have no idea, and I, you know, the onus is on him to be intelligible. But here's the thing, Kant. I mean, the very first time you read Kant, it seems like gobbledygook, but it is its sort of own language. But you can learn the language, and when you do, you see that it is intelligible. He knows what he's saying. At you know, 95%+ of the time, he knows what he's saying. And it might be totally wrong. It might be fantastical, but it's not literal. It's not gibberish. The biggest barriers are twofold. One is that Kant has an enormous theoretical vocabulary, some of which is sort of drawn from the rationalist tradition before him, and some of which is him taking some of those terms and some terms of his own or terms that they use and just putting them in a new spin. And with very little introduction, often it's like way later where he finally explains, by this I mean, and you're like, oh, that's what you meant this last 20 pages. So one thing that I started in those Kant courses with is just a glossary. It's just kind of going through these different terms and explaining. And I know it seems overly complicated to say, well, there are a priori forms of sensibility, and the a priori forms of sensibility or the a priori intuitions of, and you're like, why are you, you know, can't you simplify it? And I'm like, yes, I could. But then when you started reading it, you wouldn't know what he was saying. So the first trick is to learn his terminology. And the second trick is to master something which is partly Kant and partly German, which is his style of writing, which is his sentences are paragraphs. And the kind of unit of argument for Kant is a sentence. That is to say that like an entire argument will be one sentence. But what the only way to do it as I teach students to do it. And let's say you're working from an English translation, although this would hold true in German too, which is you look for the subject and then you look for the verb or the predicate. If it's German, it'll be all the way at the end, you know, 10 lines later. And then you first just say like, what is the basic subject of a sentence? What is the basic predicate of a sentence? Blah, blah. And you're like, okay, think of that as like the heading of this paragraph, which is a sentence. Then what you get, because it's German, is a series of dependent clauses, usually noun clauses. You're like, the this being so, da 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 da. And also, by the way, da 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 da. And parenthetically, da 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 da. And then take each one as a separate sentence. And then just process them one at a time. Even turn it into different sentences. And then it's readable. And then you're like, oh, okay, he's saying this. Side note A, side note B, side note C. Clarification, alpha, you know, example two, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. And between those things, glossary and breaking down the very complex paragraph argument sentences, it, and then just practice it, it becomes intelligible. And I swear to the listener, you know, the first time I read Kant, I did not know what a word of it was. But within a year or two, I was reading Kant and more, I think, more or less understanding what he was trying to say most of the time.
I am tempted to keep this topic going, but I want to make sure we get to Enric's super chat. Super chatted last week and again this week, but I was already going to read his super chat from last week. So you played yourself, Enric. You got tricked. I'm kidding. But thank you for the two super chats. Last week he said, if Kant had been around during Darwin's Origin of the Species, would Kant have accepted that the senses must know reality to their purpose for evolutionary requirements? And then he asked a similar question this week. I think he was,
No, I don't think he would have. I think he would have fundamentally understood the senses the way they are, because it's much more fundamental. Like it's simpler to say, like, when Darwin used his eyes, were they giving him phenomena or noumena? And Kant would say they were giving him phenomena. Now what the theory of evolution might have affected was some of Kant's views about teleology, which he develops in the third critique, the critique of the power of judgment, or the faculty of judgment. Because Kant thinks that we cannot help but see a kind of teleology in nature, but he thinks that it's sort of subjective and more subjective than the categories, because the categories, they structure reality for us in a way that reality for us can't be otherwise. With regard to the way we see teleology, like it seems like the scorpion's tail is for stinging things. Kant thinks like, probably, like, if you just look at physics and chemistry, it's just stuff happening. We put onto it this idea of a function, and we can't sort of help but think of it functionally, but it's sort of even within the phenomena, it's not really. And maybe Darwin would have pushed him into thinking, okay, maybe like it's deeper than that. And maybe he would have tried to think of natural selection as a kind of teleological principle that is imposed on the phenomena. I don't know, but it might have affected his teleology. Might have. That's not an area of Kant that I'm super strong on, but it would not have affected his view about the senses and the Copernican revolution.
Right. I mean, yeah, Darwin himself and his books are within the phenomenal world. But let me read a few more super. Well, just acknowledge some super chats. Marilyn, thank you. Jonathan, thank you. Jonathan again, thank you. Jonathan again, thank you. Jonathan again, thank you. Marilyn, thank you. Bonnie, thank you. Gail, thank you. Enric asking, okay, again about Darwinism. Thank you, Enric, and thank you, Jonathan again.
That's a great question, Enric.
And then, okay, Rat Lover with 10 pounds says, I have an idea. Comparing Ayn Rand to Alex Jones and comparing Ayn Rand to Breitbart might inspire some rap battles, kind of like Kant versus Rand rap battle. Okay, this is something they were talking about in the chat room. I think Alex Jones versus a dead rat would probably be a good, sorry for insulting rats, Rat Lover, since that's your name. But I think Alex Jones versus maybe a piece of excrement on the sidewalk would be a fair match, I suppose. I would not want to... insult Ayn Rand by putting her in the same rap battle as Alex Jones. But okay.
Here's an interesting thought experiment for you. What's something that even Alex Jones wouldn't peddle as a bullshit cure for COVID or otherwise? Is there anything even Alex Jones wouldn't do?
Is this like a board game for parties?
I don't know. I don't know if there's an answer. It might be like, no, he'd do it.
Sounds like a Thursday collective game. That's our new format we're doing, these thought exercises. But okay, and then since we have a couple minutes left, so Michael last week super chatted, Plato and Kant devised the best system for narcissists with an inferiority complex to rule over others. Does that sound like the kind of thing I have been trying to say we need to cool down and refrain from saying? Or what do you make of that remark?
I don't know where, I mean, I'm not sure where exactly where it's coming from. Look, any bad philosophy fuels rationalization. It's not as if narcissists have a paucity of rationalization at any given time. They are kind of rationalization factories. But look, is it true that certain kinds of philosophies, particularly certain kinds of mystical philosophies, give, you know, what Rand at one point called the witch doctor type, a kind of vehicle for their hostility against the world and against life and against people more competent in the practical realm than themselves? Yeah, they do. I don't know that in this respect, Plato's or Kant's is more significant than Marx's or the Stoics or something like that. You know, in general, the more morality is thou shalt, the more of it, there's going to be somebody taking the responsibility of telling you thou shalt. And the more that an epistemology says you can't trust your knowledge of blank, the more some opportunist is going to take that opportunity. And the more that a philosophy says, and this is more in line with Plato or Plato's descendants than Kant, but the more it tends to say there's a special access to true hidden truth that only some of us have and not others, the more there are going to be con men and narcissists and megalomaniacs who think that they speak with the word of God or the vision of the forms or what have you. But I don't think that, but that's, you know, I don't know if it's uniquely Plato and Kant. I mean, look, Plato and Kant are responsible sort of for the most philosophical damage to Western civilization. Plato is also responsible for giving Western civilization structured philosophy. And now, thank goodness for Aristotle kind of revising so much of what Plato did with it. But Plato created our field of philosophy as we know it, or the bones of it, and many of its key questions. So Plato is a very complicated case, positive and negative. Although on the whole, I think he is philosophically a negative force. That's the most I want to say about that. I don't like Rucka. I don't find that tone of statement particularly constructive, but I don't deny the validity of investigating the ways in which particular philosophies are conducive to illicit behavior, mismanagement of power, or even personality disorders. I mean, I think that's a valid question.
Yeah, a lot of this could be valid. I mean, I think, you know, Ayn Rand earned the right to say, you know, Kant was pulling a fast one. She, you know, and anyone else who really takes the time to study Kant can say if whether they think he was lying or making things complicated on purpose to trick everybody. But, you know, the average person who read, you know, causality versus duty is not at that level. So I would caution. I would recommend prudence. Now we do need to wrap it up, unfortunately. Thank you, Rat Lover, for the super chat again. And coming up at 7 p.m. UK time in a few minutes, Jim Brown on supply chain disruptions. And then at 8 p.m. UK time, Rozzy and Jim Valiant on A Philosopher Looks at the OJ Verdict, the Leonard Peikoff lecture. Last minute thought?
Yeah. Yeah. I believe Rozzy told me, I mean, this may be subject to change, but next week that Nikos and I are going to be speaking about lived experience. I'll try to have some unlived experience in the meantime to compare.
Yeah. Right. As opposed
but,
to that.
No, but I do think it'd be nice if at some point you want to do, if after that you want to do like Kant's ethics and talk about that, I think that would be, you know, that'd be fun.
Awesome. I am in. All right, everybody. No time for Clubhouse, but Jason, if you feel like starting a room later in the day, obviously a bunch of us will be there. All right. Thanks for this.
Thank you.
See you guys all very soon, and goodbye.